now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. To Australia.
Hello, Dean Haglund.
Hello, Phil Lairness. And a happy Labor Day from down under.
I feel like this is the fourth Labor Day, happy or otherwise, you've wished us from down under in the last months.
This is the official one. The other one I was, you know, celebrating from other countries. But, you know, I'm all about the labor.
So you celebrate all countries' Labor Days.
Yeah, I didn't realize they mixed them up so much. But when you travel around, you suddenly realize, hey, everybody sort of picks a day to call it Labor Day so that they can all take an extra day off and not do labor.
Well, it was a great story.
I got 1,000 like that.
You know, you alluded to the fact that you're the clock changed there. So now are you... What are you, 18 hours or 16 hours? What does that mean? Different.
It's spring, so it sprung ahead. So technically, we're 18 hours different.
18 hours different.
Right, so it's already evening of the next day. So
now that that is the name of your memoir. The evening of the next day.
Wow.
All right, I guess we should get this show started.
Why
not? And when I say we, I mean me, yours truly, your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness. I produced 4 short films this weekend.
What?
Yeah, 4. And I had to pull double duty on all of them. Like, I assistant directed one of them. I DP'd 2 of them. It was madness. But it did not prevent me from attending a couple of late night screenings. Midnight screenings there to prep for this show. So give till it hurts. You're welcome, Chilpack Nation. We used to almost every week, it seemed, discuss live events of the week. Lawsuits of the week. We frequently would discuss explanations of the week and, of course, celebrity deaths. I feel that since you left for Australia, we are more likely to discuss American gun massacres than we are any of our supposed weekly topics.
Wow. Isn't that true? Was that me being a calming influence, or is that just the whole town's going crazy?
I guess, or you getting out when the getting was good.
Well, don't kid yourself. We had gun violence here. Policeman shot by a 15-year-old who then was taken out and... That happened right a couple kilometers from where I live.
Well, that is interesting. Of course, here it's the 15-year-olds getting shot by cops, so we do it the other way around.
Right.
You know, this latest shooting, I'm sure you heard about at the college in near Portland in Oregon, which I guess is now, I mean, did I read correctly that it's our worst gun shooting violent episode in America's history? I don't know. All I know is it was bad, right? Was it 9 people dead, 9 wounded, and the gunman, supposedly there was a religious element after shooting after coming in to a professor's class and shooting the professor right after saying, "I've been waiting for years to do this." He then had the terrified students stand up one by one and declare what their religion was, and then killed them.
Right.
So what do we add to this one that we haven't said again and again every few weeks, that we won't be called upon again to speak to a few weeks from now, no doubt.
Yeah.
I
thought that the thing that Obama pointed out, that when, you know, we added seatbelts when the cars were killing people and we made roads safer, and how is this not just a infrastructure kind of argument?
Well, I mean, you know, because the government's trying to take your guns, man. And there is this whole kind of buying in to the conspiracy idea that the government, you know, might be trying to come and take away your guns, because the fascinating piece to me about how this one was handled was the local police, the chief coming on air to share the details they had and announcing that he would not be naming the shooter, but, you know, by name. They would release the shooter's name to the media, but it would never be uttered by any member of their police force. And he, he advocated that the media never publish or mention the shooter's name. And it was interesting because when I first read the reports in the hours immediately after this massacre, I did read his name. And then after the chief made that statement, I found all reference to the shooter suddenly disappearing. And I thought, you know, that this was interesting because I said, okay, why would they do this? Why? What would be the meaning behind this? Because you know that it wasn't just the whim of a police chief. Some thought went into this.
Well, yeah, because a lot of them go on social networks going, I'm about to be famous, just before they go on one of these sprees, as a way to be notorious.
Yeah, and so I thought, wow, well, that is powerful, right? This idea,
right,
that they are going to, that in the immediate wake of this, the police are already thinking, we are going to send the message to anyone else out there that if you do this, you will die unknown. Right?
Right.
You will die absolutely anonymously. And I thought, okay, well, that's a powerful message to send. But
right, particularly if that's the motive half the motive of doing these shootings in the first place.
Yeah, if at least in whatever dark level of insanity they've dropped into, temporary or otherwise, if that's in that mix, yeah, they're speaking to that. They're planting that voice in. And, you know, that really is what you want to do. You know, you can never fix anyone. You can never save anyone. But you can try to establish yourself as a voice, a potential voice that they might hear in that moment of succumbing
right
to such darkness. But I couldn't help thinking that there had to be the conspiracy-minded among us that might look at that refusal to name the shooter and might say, ah, there's a cover-up already afoot here. Here's another person who is subject to MK Ultra or something else, who was put up to this by forces that seek to justify trying to take our guns away from us.
Interesting. So you are
I'm not saying that that's what's going on, but I wouldn't be shocked if that is not something that people have thought or maybe even expressed. You put your ear to the ground, Dean Haglund, in the conspiracy world, and let me know whether that desire to keep the identity of this shooter anonymous might rankle some people who don't trust the police, who don't trust government.
Yeah, I could see that being a line of logic, but it to me, the line of logic of let's not make these people famous is a more simple Occam's razor of the simplest solution being the right one.
Oh, well, but now if you're going to expect conspiracy theorists to follow Occam's razor,
yeah,
what happened to you going down under is all I want to ask you.
Wow.
The very fact you
have
can't,
I changed that much?
The very fact you can't prove it, remember, is proof that this desk is controlling my mind.
That's right.
I would just be curious if that was because, let's face it, there is great distrust. And understandably, there is great distrust towards the police and the government. That's the part I don't have any problem with because, you know, if the being a police officer is supposed to be a tough job. The only place where it's an easy job is in a police state. It is supposed to be hard. And
right.
And leading and governing is supposed to be a hard job. And you know why it's supposed to be a hard job? Because you're supposed to care about the people. And so naturally, it's going to be a very, very difficult job, right?
Yeah.
Because you have to make decisions and compromises that a lot of the people are not going to be happy with. And that, if you are a person of good conscience, is going to make it full of turmoil, that job.
That's
if you are of good conscience. But the reason we don't trust government and the reason we don't trust the police is that they have proven themselves time and time again to not be trustworthy.
Yes.
So they have to, in order to regain public trust, it seems to me, to behave in a clear and open. What's the word that President Obama used when he was into office? Not opaque. Opaque's not the word. What's the word?
Transparent.
Transparent. Thank you very much. I always now associate that with Jeffrey Tambor, Changing Sexes. But anyway, yeah, you have to behave in a transparent manner. But now here is something where the police are intentionally not behaving in a transparent manner. At least it could seem that way. And but I agree with you. I think you're right. You apply Occam's razor. You apply what we know about psychology. It makes a great deal of sense. Ah. But what a perfect conspiracy that is to make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that you said that.
Oh, that's terrible. All right. So there goes our gun violence death of the week. And, you know, what I'm going to do in the days to come, again, that we've done in the past, is I'm going to see what I can find out about each of the victims, and perhaps we'll celebrate their lives a little bit on a future episode of the show.
Well, there you go. Okay.
But let's do a little lawsuit of the week, shall we?
Let's do it.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
Thank you, Garrett Watley. Did you see that an Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission judge by the name of Sharon Calhoun found the production team known as Film Allman, so named because the film Midnight Rider was a biopic of Greg Allman, found the production team Film Allman to have repeatedly misrepresented the facts in court during that civil case. And this is a direct quote, demonstrated a plain indifference to the safety of its subordinate employees of the highest order on
set,
which resulted in the death of Sarah Jones and the injury to several others. Let's not forget that many people on that crew, Sarah died, we don't want to forget that, but many people were injured. This was a massive failing.
Jumping from the train tracks to, you know, in a flee for their life, you know, that was high up.
The judge characterized statements by filmmaker Randall Miller and other members of the supervising crew as, quote, misrepresentation, contradictory, and patently false.
Ouch.
Characterized their actions as absurd, and the lawyers' arguments on their behalf as nonsensical, and this is my favorite quote, to call lawyers' arguments this, arguments plural, as, quote, obviously untrue. So one has to wonder, in those circumstances, could we be seeing any kind of action taken against the lawyers who defended the Allman film team?
Wow, that would be tough, because you would think that they are aware of their client's situation. So they're trying to put the best light forward, and do they then cross a line? I mean, is it the lawyers fiduciary duty to stand up and go, I'm sorry, Your Honor, my client is lying?
Well, on the stand? But I would think that the, and again, I'm not a lawyer, I just play one on TV, but I would imagine that if they cross the line from saying it is my client's contention, if they cross the line from that to saying that contention is in fact what happened, and they knew that that was not what happened, well, then, yeah, then they misrepresented themselves, right? I mean, they did lie.
Except did that information come on cross-examination of the other team's lawyer? And that's when they were given it. You know, if it was their lawyer grilling them on the stand and they were lying.
All of which, though, underscores what the lawyers ought to have done if they... You know, I mean, if they cared in any way, and I understand that you're not in business as a lawyer, you're always in business to attract future clients. So how you represent this client, but honestly, well, there's that word, honestly. I mean,
talking lawyers.
Would any of these filmmakers have been in the trouble or had the verdict against them that they did if they had just come clean? If they had just said, you know, here's exactly how this all played out, and you know what? You're absolutely right. We're liable. We're responsible. We did this. We overlooked it. And all we can say is we were under enormous pressure, time, money. We lost our heads, as you and I have seen people do on sets.
On sets all the time. You lose your head.
You know,
there's so much going on.
Overworked, too little sleep. Too much pressure. You begin to think this stuff is life and death, and it isn't until something life and death happens that you realize, oh, it isn't. And this is not to let them off the hook. It's just to say that lying about it and misrepresenting it is it only made it worse. Only made it worse. And if they had come out and tried to get out in front of this and said, look, we deserve to be punished. We did this wrong. We want to explain everything that happened because we realize that we got wrapped up in a problem that is systemic throughout film production. And unless we admit wholly to what we did, we're scared this will never change on other sets. So we can't undo what we did. We can't bring Sarah back. But we can hopefully, by fully confessing to everything that happened, maybe prevent someone in the future from dying under similar circumstances. And I think if they do that, their fates are certainly no worse, and
than
maybe
where they are now.
Even a little bit better. And and when they serve their time and they serve their punishment, probably they have more of an opportunity to pursue a career in the business if they wish to.
Than they do right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the other thing. You know, I'm sure the other legal advice, they were saying, well, you do what, you know, say the sentence that you just said, now you're opening yourself up for a whole can of civil suits from every employee that jumped off that bridge to save their life.
Right, and, you're right. So the lawyers are telling you to limit liability.
Yeah, because, you know, you're doing damage control as a... method of operation, and how far do you go to control that damage? Do you, you know, lie outright or misrepresent and be complete idiots on the stand? Now, did you say this film company is called Film Allman?
Allman, like Greg Allman, about whom the film is, or was.
I'm looking at their,
'cause they never finished it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at their IMDb profile. It is blank. It has been scrubbed clean, except for an address and a phone number.
Well, let's be calling that. Well, let's give out that phone number.
Yeah, exactly.
So the other bit of interesting behaving badly on set, certainly not to the level of what happened in this instance, but really shockingly exploitative, and who knows what the ramifications of that are to the people who were on the receiving end of this kind of behavior. But did you read at all about what was going on the set of HBO's adaptation of Westworld?
Yes, and the contract that you have to sign that says you're going to do nudity, and not just nudity, but you're going to simulate some blowjobs. And what was the other one? They were like, holy smokes, what am I doing on this thing?
These were extras. These were background performers, and they were union background performers because, of course, this is a big budget project. So these are members of the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA. They're working under a union contract. And, a consent form, which was allegedly promulgated by Central Casting, which is a famous extras casting agency.
Yeah, the big Los one.
They cast the extras for the science fiction series. It said that the extras would be, quote, required to take part in graphic sexual situations, including, now this is on that breakdown, genital-to-genital touching and simulated oral sex with hand to genital touching, saying the consent form was not requested, written, or approved by HBO, Warner Brothers Television, or the producers, and contains situations that we do not require of any actor. So this is really strange. So it's extras, and they had to do this. Apparently, you know, according to Central Casting, HBO didn't know about this. But once it came out, SAG-AFTRA is now involved, and they really want to know why it took HBO so long to rectify the situation, because apparently SAG-AFTRA sent this consent form to HBO on a Tuesday, requested that the document be changed to accurately reflect what the contractual provisions are, because that is just patently illegal, what they were forcing these people to do. It cannot be a condition of employment. And HBO had every opportunity to rectify the situation, and it was only after their direct refusal to remedy this that SAG-AFTRA then posted that notice to their website.
Oh.
At which point HBO said, hey, we're going to do the right thing. So now SAG is saying, well, we're glad HBO is doing the right thing, but it's disappointing that they had to, that it took public measures of shaming to get them to comply with the terms of their SAG-AFTRA agreement.
Well, and I think this goes back to the business model at HBO, which they derived as their success, is that they're very hands-off on dictating to the creative what their mandate has to be. So you get, they give a lot of free rein to directors, writers, creators of shows, and that's why you get this amazing, unique television on HBO that you don't see elsewhere, because you have lawyers, standards and measures, you know, all of these guys coming in on scripts on the network level that always then suddenly shaves off the edges, dulls it down, whereas HBO specifically doesn't do that. So I could see then something coming in and maybe, and this, I don't know why I'm defending HBO right now, but maybe they don't even have the manpower or the police force, as it were, on executive level to make those kind of decisions when that comes across their desk.
It just does seem weird, though. I mean, if the union contacts you and tells you, hey, this is going on, ignoring it until the union goes public about it seems odd.
It seems odd and irresponsible.
Yeah.
And also a situation HBO may have never faced before, because the solution for HBO has always been throw more money at it.
And so you're saying that they might have actually been scared of the creatives involved in their show.
Absolutely. And so they just said, can we just, you know, buy our way out of this? How much money does it take to digitally make everybody naked, or, you know, whatever? So I'm sure that the budgets were going up through the roof as everybody was just, because I know for a fact that's a HBO solution, is just, you know, throw money at it.
And of course, HBO in this instance would be the producer. They would be the signatory. So they are the ones responsible, even if they're not allowed to call any creative shots on that show they're producing. They are the right ones who are liable, in, I would imagine, in that contract situation to SAG. You know, we've been talking week after week now, and it's been fun celebrating supporting actors, the art and commerce of being a supporting player and a character actor in Hollywood. But I've been looking for an opportunity, actually, to maybe just one week talk about background performers and extras instead of character actors, because we never do. Nobody ever does. And when better, I mean, you know, than right now when we were talking about them because they're being exploited so much. And
totally.
And I've been thinking about background performers, honestly, more and more because they distract me more and more in television and films. And, you know, having done second unit so much now as a director, you work with background a great deal and you understand the importance. You know, we talk about how if a supporting player, you know, is in some ways really responsible for whether you believe the world you're seeing. What about those teams of people that you see in the backgrounds of these scenes? If you don't believe them, if you see that they're all just people sitting there reacting to cues, that can take you out of something so fast, as it did throughout season two of True Detective. There's a big payoff in, I think, the John Wayne Airport. And dear Lord, all I can watch is how these extras are walking from point A to point B, because they were instructed to walk from point A to point B. There is no thought process going on in them. You know how we talk about how actors, you know, when you see good acting, part of it is that you're glimpsing the life of the character outside the scene you're playing. You're watching real people, and we all have multiple things going on in our lives that we're thinking about, even as we're doing something else important. And there is no thought on the face of these people, and it's not their fault. And you know, some of the people who do work for a living as background performers, you know, they'll say how often they just have to come up with something themselves that their character's thinking about. And you can really tell the difference, but it's stunning. And one of the movies where the background performers distract me sometime is my own movie, The Lady Killers.
No.
Sometimes the background performers are great, and other times I go, "Wow, what is going on there?" And in honesty, you know, sometimes I, as a director, was paying attention to them, and sometimes I wasn't, because
and sometimes you wasn't. You were just hoping they were being in the background,
doing fine. Exactly, on the actors, and that is what happens on a set, right? The director almost never directs the background performers. The extras, that's the job of either second unit or an assistant director or what have you. And they have the assistant directors have a lot of stuff going on. So it really is. But the amazing thing about it, I don't want to be criticizing, it's just how the business has changed. And I thought it was an interesting parallel to, you know, you go back to the golden age of Hollywood and the studio system and all those dozens and dozens of great character actors and supporting actors where, you know, they might do six movies a year and every one they're so good and believable. And you just know, man, if these supporting actors are in this movie, I bet this movie has a really good chance of being good. You don't even have to tell me who the lead is.
Right.
But the thing was, you looked at the background performances in these movies. They were phenomenal. And they were phenomenal because these were studio players under contract, who had yet to build up to speaking parts.
Right.
Now, that was the process. You took acting classes. You took all those lessons. You broke in by doing background work, by getting experience on the set. And so not only are they thinking about things, not only are they believably carrying out their action, but you watch extras during like the 40s and 50s in these movies, in great movies, at least, the background players are playing actual characters.
Yes, real life people.
It's unbelievable. And so that got my attention. Like, I was watching, I think it was maybe Crisscross, the Burt Lancaster film noir, and I'm going, oh my goodness, in this nightclub scene, these background players are they're characters. They're flesh and blood, three-dimensional characters, and they don't even get to speak. But I'm seeing the real world here. And then all of a sudden I'm going, and that one's Tony Curtis.
Really?
Yeah, an extra. Doing an extra role. He had yet to graduate to speaking parts yet. And
wow.
So many of these huge Hollywood stars. We talked about Veronica Lake a couple weeks ago, right?
Right.
Before she became a star, she did a few, she played, quote, co-eds in, you know, some college age movies. And she was just an unspeaking part, someone who lived in the sorority and stuff. But that's what they did. You know, we want to see you on screen. We want to see you act before we trust you to have principal action or dialogue.
Well, and X-Files' very own David Duchovny was a background in Working Girls with Harrison Ford and Sigourney Weaver. You can see him in the party scene in the background with no speaking lines and uncredited.
That's interesting. You know, Matt Damon did some of that as well.
See?
How about Sam Jackson? Right? Sam Jackson was Bill Cosby's stand-in. This is not same as extra work per se, but again, it's you know, paying your dues, getting on-set experience. He was Bill Cosby's stand-in on The Cosby Show.
I did not know that.
Yes.
So, yeah. So if you want to see an example of a background actor taking focus so badly from your leads, look no further than I think it's the first Mission Impossible, Tom Cruise Mission Impossible, and go to the very last scene of the movie at an outdoor cafe in Budapest, I think it's filmed, and the way it's framed, it's you have Tom Cruise on one side and I forget who the other actor he's talking with at the cafe, sort of filling up the left and right frame, and then your background extras at other outdoor coffee tables are kind of center frame, and there's a woman who's running her fingers through her hair, and you swear to God she's another spy or she's going to do something.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Once you said that, I know exactly what you're talking about, and ends up not being anything.
Not anything, but you're so focused on her about to be, you know, taking you to the sequel or something that all you don't even know what the hell the conversation was. You're just staring at this extra who's doing way too much.
This is a tough one. I mean, but I'll just ask you. So there's a couple ways of looking at this. One is if you're noticing the extras, doesn't that mean that the principal talent, and I don't mean just the actors, I mean the writer, the director, maybe even the cinematographer, the actors, that collectively they've fallen down on the job a little bit if you're noticing the problem of the extras, or is it just indicative of the larger problem? You know, that the what am I trying to say? I don't know what I'm trying to say, but respond to that.
Well, yeah, because it's a double-edged sword, right? You're not making the main action enough that the viewer's eye is wandering to what else is going on in the scene. And that is a problem of how you focus, how you've staged the conversation, how, you know, the cinematographer has lined up the shot. It's a creative endeavor. So when something goes wrong, there's a lot of finger pointing that can be done.
But that's it. It is this interesting line, though, because at the same time, you don't want to always have your direction, your attention directed. You want to be able to explore that frame and that world. And,
true.
And if we were believing it, if we were buying that world, we wouldn't be straying so much anyway, and we would be more interested in what's going on with that principal talent. You know, it works that way too. Once you are aware that, okay, this world is a real world, this is interesting, then you're probably drawn back, interestingly enough, by that, back to your lead actors.
Yeah. And that, you can point to the famous Star Trek, it's told at all the Trek conventions by Walter Koenig, from the Star Trek movie where they find the whales, save the whales. Which episode was that one?
Voyage Home, Star Trek 4.
Voyage Home. And so they're in San Francisco and they're trying to ask for directions. And the original direction to all the extras was pay no attention, just keep walking by. And one extra just stops and just starts nattering on at them in a hilarious voice. And they kept that in and she got a credit for that. Now there's a case of an extra who's taking way too much focus, taking a huge risk, but succeeding in that it was a funny scene.
Right, and it does bring you back to how your beloved characters are going to react to it.
Absolutely, and making, you know, 1980s San Francisco seem completely weird and nutty, which, you know, helped the storyline along. Having said that,
yeah,
I don't recommend any background performer tries that.
No, but again, it is, even if you're not being directed to this, you know, you are playing a character. You have a reason to be going where you're going. You have a reason to be doing what you're doing. And the more you can do that and embody that, the more practice you're getting at acting, right? I mean, it's the same things I'm looking for in a background performance are the same things I'm looking for in the principal performance. Like, you know, we discussed, I want to see real people. I want to see an embodiment of energy, right? I want to see emotional reality. I want to see someone who's affected by their surroundings, for crying out loud. That's what makes the surroundings seem real, right?
Absolutely. That it's not a set, that it's a real place that you're in and not just waiting for craft service on the other side of the table.
You and I both agreed to participate in a series of discussions that our friend Alex Lefchuk, who I speak to on a weekly basis as part of his radio show, The Midweek Drive, there for Siren FM. He's a professor, of course, at University of Lincoln in all manner of media and culture and and they're doing a seminar, I guess, on classic science fiction films. And
yes.
So we're going to participate in a few discussions. And one of the two films I'm discussing is 1976's Logan's Run.
Oh, fantastic. Which has one of the very first explanations of Tinder. Do you realize?
Absolutely. I wrote that in my notes. That how prescient this is for people, even people who haven't seen the film, most people are somewhat aware of the movie because of its very clever conceit of in a future world when you get to be 30, basically you're put to death, that no one lives past 30, and it's kind of derided and dismissed to this day by many people as just being a silly film. And I'm going to talk a lot about how its prescience and honestly, its very rich metaphoric and metaphysical underpinnings of this movie.
Very true.
Are resonant and are allowed to endure because of its silliness, not in spite of it. That you know, all too often, especially today, the message gets burdened by the earnestness, by the seriousness, and instead by taking this tone of kind of delight and little bit of silliness. And yes, this is something that we do want to have appeal to the youngest among us. You give a chance for people to find the messages on their own term. But the other thing, you're absolutely right, there was some really clever and prescient awareness on the part of the filmmakers so that the social satire aspects of it really weren't about 1976. They were about the culture that I believe they saw we were becoming.
Yeah, in 2016, they sort of nailed it. A lot of it.
I mean, how about, you know, this whole idea of you're dead after 30 being this is 1976, this is pre-Star Wars, and yet they totally saw how the culture was going to be one where suddenly everything is aimed at exploiting youth. Not just exploiting youth to sell things, but to sell things to the youngest people. As we've talked before, how can any economy be based on trying to squeeze money out of the one group of people that you culturally need to be having save their money? And, namely, you know, what, the 15 to 25-year-olds or the 15 to 30-year-olds. And so it really saw where show business, and then again, culture at large was going to be going. But anyway, so I'll be talking in depth about Logan's Run. You'll be talking about Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
Yes.
And
when are we doing this, by the way? I should get my notes out.
Well, I know I'm recording this week, but I thought you and Alex probably were communicating with each other to set up a time.
Oh, he did shoot me an email. I'm way behind on those.
So when we do that, we'll let our listeners know, and it could be fun. I guess they're going to be 20 to 30 minute conversations in depth about not just an analysis of the film, though that'll be part of it, I'm sure, but also like why it affected us when we first saw it and why it still resonates with us.
Yes.
Or why it doesn't in some ways resonate as much. You know, how does it fit into the landscape of how we view films now? So it's a personal, exploration of it, while at the same time, we can't avoid doing textual and subtextual analysis, so it should be fun.
Look forward to that.
I caught a couple new films currently in release,
yeah.
But I also finally caught up on a documentary, multiple Oscar nominated documentary from last year, Glenn Campbell, All Be Me.
Oh my gosh, him off on his Alzheimer's tour, tour he'll remember.
First of all, shock. Well, he didn't even remember it after that. You know, he's Glenn Campbell, famous musician, right? I mean,
yeah.
Not
Rhinestone
just,
Cowboy.
Yeah, not just his hits, not just 50 million records sold, not just a hit song, not just starring in Oscar-winning movies like True Grit,
right.
But he was also the ultimate session musician before that. I mean, he's the guitar player on the Beach Boys records, for crying out loud, you know? He played
right.
guitar for Elvis. I mean, he was one of the real go-to guys. So fascinating in that regard. And you really, you know, you don't have to be a fan of his music per se. You do have to be a fan of music, which, as we know, Dean Hagland, you are not.
That's right.
But directed by James Keach, you know, Stacy Keach's brother, who himself back in the 70s was quite a big deal. So I thought that was interesting. But a really... I don't know if nice is the right word, but a really interesting and original way of looking at not just what gets visited upon the person suffering from dementia and on the people around them, but also on, you know, the lack of awareness and how little as a culture we're doing and how dangerous it is, not only for future generations of people, because the numbers of people suffering from dementia are escalating, but also economically, mm-hmm. what this is going to do to us unless we try to find some kind of cure for this.
Right.
It's extraordinary.
Because of the resources needed to take care of that.
Yeah, to take care of people. And but also how interesting it is that the music centers of the brain can go unaffected for so long, not just in him, but apparently in all people. So music therapy is one of the things that people do. So here's a guy who can't remember his children's names who are on stage with him, but he can perform. He's tonally still perfect, and he can do these, you know, he'll read on the prompter that it says do a guitar solo, and then he'll launch into this amazing virtuoso performance on the guitar.
Isn't that amazing? You would think that's sort of a thing to go. There was another visual artist who was diagnosed, and he painted a picture a day, often a self-portrait, as a document, as his descent. And you see his skills going quite early on. So it's fascinating to hear that music is one of the last remaining art forms that you would have.
I saw the current release, Black Mass, from director Scott Cooper. This is about James Whitey Bulger, played by Johnny Depp. It is such a relief to see Johnny Depp give a damn. And, you know, to do good work in a pretty good movie. You know, the work he's doing deserves probably a movie a little more inventive and original. You know, we can't help but feel we've seen so much of this before. Even though it's a true story, I actually feel like, you know, The Departed, which was a remake of a Hong Kong film, Scorsese's The Departed, I can't help but really strongly believe that Jack Nicholson's character in The Departed is based on the real life James Whitey Bulger. The details are so similar. But you know, it reminds you that it's so many scenes are right out of Casino. There's another Scorsese film. Did he perhaps base this on real life incidents? You know, I think a lot of guys who make gangster films that really resonate, you know, with us, probably it's because they're taking some very real life, you know, details. Yeah. So there's a sameness to the approach and that we're seeing. But I also was just disappointed that structurally, kind of the two parts of the story that you don't get to see, and as we know, you do want to make a choice in a biopic almost always, do a period of time in the person's life. That's your best bet to make it good. Don't do the whole shebang. However, there's two parts of James Whitey Bulger's story that are fascinating that only get dealt with either through dialogue or through postscript. And the one is, this is a guy who served a long stint in Leavenworth and Alcatraz before becoming a criminal kingpin.
What? I did not know that.
So exactly. So wait a minute. I want to know about that. And then... how about the fact that, as we when he disappears from Boston, when it all implodes and it's all revealed that he was a FBI informant since 76, he disappears, never to be seen again until 2011 when he's arrested in Santa Monica. So he's been living for all these years in Santa Monica. I want to know what James Whitey Bulger, who went from personally, not only overseeing, but personally killing people on a daily basis and seemingly enjoying it. I mean, a complete sociopath.
Right.
What's he doing in Santa Monica on a daily basis?
And you read his neighbors said, oh, he was pretty quiet and he would take a daily walk with his dog along the beach. He was living like a retiree would in, you know, enjoying the sunsets. Watching the sun, like, it staggers the mind that you could just compartmentalize it from murder and mayhem in Boston to, lovely surf and sand in Santa Monica.
And that, to me, is the story, you know?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that story. How does the guy turn the page like that? How does he flip that switch? So, anyway, it's, again, it's nice to see Johnny Depp do good work and to be scary and to be... but, you know, this is a case where, the movie's just kind of so-so, elevated through him. But then the one that is getting out of this world reviews, there's a hint for you.
Martian.
The Martian. And
dying to see it.
I, of course, as it's at the meme right now that's running through social media is, you know, we love Ridley Scott, we love Matt Damon, but now with The Martian and Interstellar and Saving Private Ryan before it, how much money does the U.S. government have to spend trying to save Matt Damon's life? Really, honestly. But... what's funny is the reviews are fantastic and I enjoyed the heck out of the movie and I love a movie that ultimately you know the whole reason it was made and the reason that it will also truly be a cultural game changer is this movie was made to get people to give a shit in America about science and math again. That's the whole reason this movie was made. Is science is cool, math is cool. Let's start doing this, and let's start realizing that
it's value.
Yeah, that we have the ability to approach any problem, no matter how insoluble it might seem. This movie never mentions climate change, but I think that it's an obvious metaphor for climate change, and it's let's stop saying that game is over. Because we're still on the playing board. So if we're on the playing board, the game's not over. Let's work the problem. yes, the problem might seem insoluble, it might seem overwhelming, but we have time right now to be doing something, so let's work the problem. And if we keep working enough problems and finding solutions, who knows how that might shift the landscape? What are you going to do? You know, and that's, and it uses the story of someone who knows, looks around, sees their circumstances, knows that their existence is a short-term death sentence. But what are they going to do with that short amount of time? They're going to try to keep themselves alive maybe a little bit longer. And the longer they can keep themselves alive, don't more possibilities come into play? Not just more possibilities of what might kill them, but more possibilities of what might save them. And so it's great fun, and it's got great humor. And it gets away with things that, you know, really honestly, I can't believe it gets away with, you know, in terms of how it structures and crafts gags and bits like this. But it,
really?
But I think that, again, the impulse behind it, almost to a degree, again, like what I'm saying with Logan's Run, you know, it's such a wonderful approach tonally to it that... you know, you let it get away with things that it shouldn't. You know, whereas if it took itself so seriously, then you might not, you know?
Well, here's a perfect segue then into our ongoing list of female directors of movies. This week I saw what may be my newest favorite sci-fi director. Her film, her name is Jennifer Fang, and her film Advantageous.
Oh, we talked about this a few weeks ago. So you enjoyed this?
I did enjoy this up until the third act. The third act was tough. I mean, it had to go there, and that was a casting problem more than anything. But
yes, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I think I mentioned that it's kind of at the beginning of the third act. It's undone. I don't think I blamed it on the casting problem, but I know what you're talking about. And part of it is that it would be really hard to live up to what came before. I do, but don't you think that it does reclaim itself at the end of the movie? That the ending is satisfying? It's not all, the third act problem is not, it's not an entire third act. It's not, at least to me, it wasn't how they resolve it. It was exactly what you said. It's the introduction of an element that disappoints you.
Yeah, it had to go there, though. I mean, you know,
yeah,
I could see when you're writing the script, you're going, well, you know, the logical progression of this story is to have that happen.
In fact, if I recall, if we played back, let's play back our conversation from a few weeks. when I talked about this film, I think I said that. Now that you say that, and that's a fascinating thing as a filmmaker to look at. That's, yeah, I think the script was absolutely lock solid. It was not a problem in scripting. And it wasn't really, quote-unquote, a problem in execution from a filming standpoint. It was another element, in this case, like you say, casting, that can go awry. That doesn't mean that it doesn't work. It's just that it doesn't live up to the standard you've set elsewhere.
Absolutely. Which then makes me ask, have you seen her other film, Half-Life?
Yes, I did. And one of the stars of that movie, Half-Life, was Alexander Agate, who played the young male lead in our movie Spectres we did so many years ago. Yes, yes.
Sure enough, look at that. Wow. Okay,
so I'm glad. So that's two huge thumbs up, as they used to say on the posters. Two huge thumbs up for Jennifer Fang's Advantageous. Yes.
Yep.
See this movie, people. I mean, here's great genre work. Who doesn't love a science fiction movie? And,
absolutely.
So check this out.
And beautifully done. Like, that's the thing. It's like, it's an imagining of a future that is at once gorgeous and also terrifying.
Well, that opening, that reveal of how we're in the future by evoking 9/11.
Yes.
And you see the building on fire, and then you see, oh no, not again. And then see spaceships flying towards the building
to the disaster.
And you go, oh my God, we're in the future. We're not seeing 9/11. We're seeing the future.
So I know, isn't that scary?
It's so cool. Yeah.
I love that.
That's exciting.
So there you go.
Another recent female directed movie. It's streaming on Netflix. Female directed movie that everyone should see. You know what people should not see, speaking of science fiction, is Fox Network's adaptation of Steven Spielberg's Minority Report.
Oh, no.
The opening teaser that sets this up is so crackerjack, and by the end of the opening credits, I had to ask, has this been canceled yet?
Oh, no. Oh, my gosh.
Wow, this is incompetent from the word go.
Are you kidding me?
And, oh, my God, talk about casting. And Megan Good, who's the lead, is not an untalented woman. She's been very good in the past. And, oh, my God, you don't believe for a moment any of these people are the jobs that they're doing.
Oh, no.
Holy Jesus, there's a ton of acting going on in this thing.
Well, that's what I like, a ton of acting. Stuff.
Big acting, people playing at being professions, wearing costumes, walking around on sets. Ooh, this is a dog. Ooh, man.
And why do they bother? I mean, I was like, oh, yeah, continue Minority Report. But now here it's 10 years later, and the precogs in the vat of water are now trying to lead normal lives. Well, why is that interesting?
You know what? Here's the answer to your question. It isn't. I also saw, I've been digging, though, the new Muppets.
Oh,
this
really?
This is the British The Office meets the Larry Sanders Show. And,
really?
And of course, which is interesting because the British The Office was inspired by the Larry Sanders Show. It is so funny. And I got into such a wicked debate on Twitter with Maddie Giles from the Maddie Giles Film Files because I called out anybody who criticizes this thing was never a fan of the original The Muppets at all. You know, they're talking about how, it lacks the heart of the original Muppets. You know, the thing that made the Muppets so great was the wicked sense of humor. And,
right.
And you know, people want to view things through the prism of how they viewed them when they were children, which brings me back to Logan's Run, understanding the arrested adolescence that would drive our you know, cultural expression. And what's great is that the people who are making this new Muppet show is going back and finding how funny these characters actually are. And it's terrifically funny. It is my favorite new comedy show that I've seen in quite some time.
Wow. And it's done still with the original Muppets and there's...
Yeah,
rods and hands. And
it's
all that sort of thing.
It's a behind the scenes show of a late night talk show, hosted by Miss Piggy and her ex lover Kermit is the executive producer of the show.
Oh my gosh! So it is the Larry Sanders Show done with Muppets.
Yeah,
fantastic! Like it already.
Boy, what do we talk about now? I mean, we've had so much reboot, remake, and adaptation news in the mix for a while, and yet we're almost out of time.
Damn it!
So I wanted to just address one thing that I alluded to last week, and again, it comes up because of this whole idea of working the problem. I've been becoming, as I said, more hopeful with more all I read and just hearing, you know, brilliant minds who are managing to stay calm amidst all the nonsensical public anger and debate over any meaningful topic. Just get more and more hopeful that the whole question of how do you rebuild an economy where the middle class has been utterly squeezed out here in America. And I got to say here in America, because, of course, you know, the truth is the history of capitalism is not one that's about middle class. The middle class being successful is such a unique thing to America post-World War II. And it was that combination of huge federal spending and a success and the money coming out of a war that really, you know, created a middle class. But it is just striking to me that all the questions about how do you build a meaningful economy that doesn't leave people behind and how do you address the pressing problems of the world, namely climate change and also, you know, fights over resources and things like this, that they all find their answer in renewables. You know, it is possible to build a renewable economy that is based around renewable energy. And And I'm actually more hopeful than I've ever been that, you know, we might be, when we're still doing this show 14 years from now.
On our solar-powered iPads.
That, you know, we're going to be living in a world where the economy's really been transformed. Not just that where climate change has been addressed, but where it's been addressed in such a way that actually leads to what I think would be, and many people apparently believe, a much more equitable economic system.
Ah, fascinating.
I'm more hopeful than ever before. And it comes back to this idea of, you know, what I expressed about the Martian, where there just seemed to be some really brilliant minds who seemed to be working the problem.
Wow.
And now,
well, that is hopeful.
And even a few of them seem to be in politics. Not most of them, but a few of them.
Wow.
That brings us to an end of another exciting installment. I want to make a programming note. Next week, we're going to have a special guest filing a report from the East Coast where the X-Files revival is going to premiere. It's not actually premiering its pilot because the pilot's going to premiere at MIPCOM, which is ongoing at Cannes right now. But a public premiere at a Comic-Con in New York City on October 10th, and we will have a correspondent there who will be filing a report, giving a review on our show that drops on October 12th, and also hipping us to what's going on in the world of Marvel television, from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. to Agent Carter, and maybe even to the forthcoming Netflix seasons of Marvel properties. So that'll be very exciting. On next week's show, but I got to ask you before I let you go, Dean, you almost broke part of the internet again by saying something about a secret episode 7 of the X-Files revival in an interview down under. What the were you talking about?
I'm a guest on Studio 10, which is a 3-hour show where, you know, upon reviewing it on YouTube. So what the full context of it was, did you enjoy your time on set? Someone asked. Absolutely. We would all love to do it again. And then somebody said, oh, so is there more happening? And I said, well, there could be. And then somebody said, so you're saying there could be a 7th episode? Yes, there could be a 7th episode. We would all love to do that. Were we asked by Fox executives? But at no time did I go, Yeah, no, there's already the footage in the can, and we're hiding an extra episode under our pants.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Explanation of the Week.
Well,
so I think I cleared that up.
Yeah, you did. So you're saying that there's a secret 7th episode.
No, I'm not. There's no secret 7 episode.
So that really, you almost broke the internet with how often that question's being asked. Of course, on the other hand, the other most common question that seems to be coming your way these days is, will you be back on the X-Files with the revival?
Yes, I know.
You know, and how you manage to ignore those without responding, hey, thanks for listening to my weekly show, fucker. I don't know. But people can check out every episode of our show that we've ever done. It's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Check it out at chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com. What else? They can write us. Where can they write us, Dean Haglin?
Write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com and follow us on Twitter at Dean and Phil. Write out the word and.
Like the show on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. As always, we thank Blog Talk Radio for hosting us. We thank Fanboy Nation for carrying us. We love Stitcher, we love iTunes, and we love Empire State Gas. It's organically grown and good for the environment. So next time you fill up at Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. I'll talk to you next week, Dean Haglin.
You take care, Phil Lerness.
Intercontinental LA to Australia.
belated spoiler alert.
I know that after 1 hour, 4 minutes, and 26 seconds of changing the way people listen to the internet, it's probably unlikely anyone is still listening. However, it had been a long time since we'd offered up an Easter egg, and I felt it was appropriate this week. On Monday, September 28th, Catherine Coulson died at 71 years of age. And her life and career reminded me yet again of something I've spoken to many times on this show, namely that no matter how much you love a particular performer because of a role they played or a show they were a part of, there is so much more to that performer and to what they can offer and probably what they have contributed than merely that role, that show. Catherine Coulson is such an example of this. She's perhaps best known for playing the Log Lady on the much-beloved David Lynch series Twin Peaks. Her log saw things. She produced David Lynch's landmark film Eraserhead, which had starred her ex-husband, Jack Nance. She has numerous credits in camera departments in motion pictures, including working as the first assistant camera person on my favorite Star Trek film, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which I think is the most impressively photographed of all the Star Trek films. And anyone who has served as a camera operator or a director of photography can tell you just how important the first assistant camera is. Catherine Coulson, you will be missed, and we will never forget that the owls are not what they seem.
Celebrity deaths.